The elevator door slid shut, cutting him off. Mike stood where he was for a moment, in the perfect New York hotel silence of what no one on the staff would admit was the 13th floor of the Hotel Dolphin, and thought of reaching out and pushing the elevator's call button. Except, if he did that, Olin would win, and there would be a large, gaping hole where the best chapter of his new book should have been. The readers might not know that. His editor and his agent might not know it. Robertson the lawyer might not. But he would. Instead of pushing the call button, he reached up and touched the cigarette behind his ear, that old, distracted gesture he no longer knew he was making, and flicked the collar of his lucky shirt. Then he started down the hallway toward 1408, swinging his overnight case by his side. 2. The most interesting artifact left in the wake of Michael Enslin's brief stay, it lasted about 70 minutes, in room 1408 was the 11 minutes of recorded tape in his mini-quarter, which was charred a bit but not even close to destroyed. The fascinating thing about the narration was how little narration there was, and how odd it became. The minicorder had been a present from his ex-wife, with whom he had remained friendly 5 years before. On his first case expedition, the Rillsby farm in Kansas, he had taken it almost as an afterthought, along with 5 yellow legal pads and a leather case filled with sharpened pencils. By the time he reached the door of room 1408 in the Hotel Dolphin 3 books later, he came with a single pen and notebook, plus 5 fresh 90-minute cassettes in addition to the one he had loaded into the machine before leaving his apartment. He had discovered that narration served him better than note-taking. He was able to catch anecdotes, some of them pretty damn great, as they happened. The bats that had dive-bombed him in the supposedly haunted tower of Gartsby Castle, for instance. He had shrieked like a girl on her first trip through a Carney-haunted house. Friends hearing it were invariably amused. The little tape recorder was more practical than written notes, too, especially when you were in a chilly New Brunswick graveyard and a squall of rain and wind collapsed your tent at 3 in the morning. You couldn't take very successful notes in such circumstances, but you could talk, which was what Mike had done, gone on talking as he struggled out of the wet, flapping canvas of his tent, never losing sight of the minicorder's comforting red eye. Over the years and the case expeditions, the Sony minicorder had become his friend. He had never recorded a first-hand account of a true supernatural event on the filament-thin ribbon of tape running between its reels, and that included the broken comments he made while in 1408. But it was probably not surprising that he had arrived at such feelings of affection for the gadget. Long-haul truckers come to love their Kenworths and Jimmy Peets. Writers treasure a certain pen or a battered old typewriter. Professional cleaning ladies are loath to give up the old Electrolux. Mike had never had to stand up to an actual ghost or psychokinetic event with only the minicorder, his version of a cross and a bunch of garlic, to protect him, but it had been there on plenty of cold, uncomfortable nights. He was hard-headed, but that didn't make him inhuman. His problems with 1408 started even before he got into the room. The door was crooked. Not by a lot, but it was crooked all right, canted just the tiniest bit to the left. It made him think first of scary movies where the director tried to indicate mental distress in one of the characters by tipping the camera on the point of view shots. This association was followed by another one, the way doors looked when you were on a boat and the weather was a little heavy. Back and forth they went. Right and left they went. Tick and talk they went, until you started to feel a bit woozy in your head and stomach. Not that he felt that way himself, not at all, but... Yes, I do. Just a little. And he would say so, too, if only because of Olin's insinuation that his attitude made it impossible for him to be fair in the undoubtedly subjective field of spook journalism. He bent over, aware that the slightly woozy feeling in his stomach left as soon as he was no longer looking at that subtly off-kilter door, unzipped the pocket on his overnighter, and took out his minicorder. He pushed record as he straightened up, saw the little red eye go on, and opened his mouth to say, "The door of room 1408 offers its own uniquely off-kilter greeting. It appears to have been set crooked, tipped slightly to the left." He said, "The door," and that was all. If you listen to the tape, you can hear both words clearly. The door, and then the click of the stop button. Because the door wasn't crooked. It was perfectly straight. Mike turned, looked at the door of 1409 across the hall, then back at the door of 1408. Both doors were the same, white with gold number plaques and gold doorknobs, both perfectly straight. Mike bent, picked up his overnight case with the same hand holding the minicorder, moved the key in his other hand toward the lock, then stopped again. The door was crooked again. This time it tilted slightly to the right. "This is ridiculous," Mike murmured. But that woozy feeling had already started in his stomach again, and it wasn't just like seasickness, it was seasickness. He had crossed to England on the QE2 a couple of years ago, and one night had been extremely rough. What Mike remembered most clearly was lying on the bed in his stateroom, always on the verge of throwing up, but never quite able to do it. And how the feeling of nauseated vertigo got worse if you looked at a doorway, or a table, or a chair, at how they would go back and forth, right and left, tick and talk. "This is Olin's fault," he thought. "Exactly what he wants. He built you up for it, buddy. He set you up for it. Man, how he'd laugh if he could see you, huh?" His thoughts broke off as he realized Olin very likely could see him. Mike looked back down the corridor toward the elevator, barely noticing that the slightly whoopsie feeling in his stomach left the moment he stopped staring at the door. Above and to the left of the elevators, he saw what he had expected, a closed-circuit camera. One of the house dicks might be looking at it this very moment, and Mike was willing to bet that Olin was right there with him, both of them grinning like apes. "Teach him to come in here and start throwing his weight and his lawyer around," Olin says. "Look at him," the security man replies, grinning more widely than ever. "White as a ghost himself, and he hasn't even touched the key to the lock yet."
"You got him, boss. Got him hook, line, and sinker."
Damned if you do, Mike thought. I stayed in the Rilsby house, slept in the room where at least two of them were killed, and I did sleep, whether you believe it or not. I spent a night right next to Jeffrey Dahmer's grave, and another two stones over from H.P. Lovecraft's. I brushed my teeth next to the tub where Sir David Smythe supposedly drowned both of his wives. I stopped being scared of campfire stories a long time ago. I'll be damned if you do. He looked back at the door, and the door was straight. He grunted, pushed the key into the lock, and turned it. The door opened. Mike stepped in. The door did not swing slowly shut behind him as he felt for the light switch, leaving him in total darkness. Besides, the lights of the apartment building next door shone through the window. He found the switch. When he flicked it, the overhead light, enclosed in a collection of dangling crystal ornaments, came on. So did the standing lamp by the desk on the far side of the room. The window was above this desk, so someone sitting there writing could pause in his work and look out on 61st Street, or jump out on 61st if the urge so took him, except... Mike set down his bag just inside the door, closed the door, and pushed record again. The little red light went on. "According to Olin, six people have jumped from the window I'm looking at," he said, "but I won't be taking any dives from the 13th floor of the Hotel Dolphin tonight. There's an iron or steel mesh grill over the outside. Better safe than sorry. 1408 is what you'd call a junior suite, I guess. The room I'm in has two chairs, a sofa, a writing desk, a cabinet that probably contains the TV and maybe a minibar. Carpet on the floor is unremarkable. Not a patch on Olin's, believe me. Wallpaper ditto. It... wait. At this point, the listener hears another click on the tape as Mike hits the stop button again. All the scant narration on the tape has that same fragmentary quality, which is utterly unlike the other 150 or so tapes in his literary agent's possession. In addition, his voice grows steadily more distracted. It is not the voice of a man at work, but of a perplexed individual who has begun talking to himself without realizing it. The elliptical nature of the tapes and that growing verbal distraction combine to give most listeners a distinct feeling of unease. Many ask that the tape be turned off long before the end is reached. Mere words on a page cannot adequately convey a listener's growing conviction that he is hearing a man lose, if not his mind, then his hold on conventional reality. But even the flat words themselves suggest that something was happening. What Mike had noticed at that point were the pictures on the walls. There were three of them. A lady in 20s-style evening dress standing on a staircase, a sailing ship done in the fashion of Currier and Ives, and a still life of fruit, the latter painted with an unpleasant yellow-orange cast to the apples as well as the oranges and bananas. All three pictures were in glass frames, and all three were crooked. He had been about to mention the crookedness on the tape, but what was so unusual, so worthy of comment about three off-kilter pictures? That a door should be crooked. Well, that had a little of that old cabinet of Dr. Caligari charm, but the door hadn't been crooked. His eyes had tricked him for a moment, that was all. The lady on the stairs tilted left. So did the sailing ship, which showed bell-bottomed British tars lining the rail to watch a school of flying fish. The yellowish-orange fruit, to Mike it looked like a bowl of fruit painted by the light of a suffocating equatorial sun, a Paul Bowles desert sun, tilted to the right. Although he was not ordinarily a fussy man, he circled the room, setting them straight. Looking at them crooked like that was making him feel a touch nauseated again. He wasn't entirely surprised, either. One grew susceptible to the feeling. He had discovered that on the QE2. He had been told that if one persevered through that period of increased susceptibility, one usually adapted. "Got your sea legs," some of the old hands still said. Mike hadn't done enough sailing to get his sea legs, nor cared to. These days he stuck with his land legs, and if straightening the three pictures in the unremarkable living room of 1408 would settle his midsection, good for him. There was dust on the glass covering the pictures. He trailed his fingers across the still life and left two parallel streaks. The dust had a greasy, slippery feel, like silk. Just before it rots, was what came into his mind, but he was damned if he was going to put that on tape either. How was he supposed to know what silk felt like just before it rotted? It was a drunk's thought. When the pictures were set to rights, he stepped back and surveyed them in turn. The evening-dress lady by the door leading into the bedroom, the ship plying one of the seven seas to the left of the writing desk, and finally the nasty, and quite badly painted, fruit by the TV cabinet. Part of him expected that they would be crooked again, or fall crooked as he looked at them. That was the way things happened in movies like The House on Haunted Hill and in old episodes of The Twilight Zone. But the pictures remained perfectly straight, as he had fixed them. Not, he told himself, that he would have found anything supernatural or paranormal in a return to their former crooked state. In his experience, reversion was the nature of things. People who had given up smoking—he touched the cigarette cocked behind his ear without being aware of it—wanted to go on smoking, and pictures that had been hanging crooked since Nixon had been president wanted to go on hanging crooked. "And they've been here a long time, no doubt about that," Mike thought. "If I lifted them away from the walls, I'd see lighter patches on the wallpaper, or bugs squirming out. The way they do when you turn over a rock." There was something both shocking and nasty about this idea. It came with a vivid image of blind white bugs oozing out of the pale and formerly protected wallpaper like living pus. Mike raised the minicorder, pushed record, and said, "Olin has certainly started a train of thought in my head, or a chain of thought. Which is it?" He set out to give me the heebie-jeebies, and he certainly succeeded. Didn't mean what? To be racist? Was heebie-jeebies short for Hebrew jeebies? But that was ridiculous. That would be Hebrew-jeebrews, a phrase which was meaningless. It, on the tape at this point, flat and perfectly articulated, Mike Enslin says, "I've got to get a hold of myself. Right now." This is followed by another click as he shuts the tape off again. He closed his eyes and took four long, measured breaths, holding each one in to a five count before letting it out again. Nothing like this had ever happened to him, not in the supposedly haunted houses, the supposedly haunted graveyards, or the supposedly haunted castles. This wasn't like being haunted, or what he imagined being haunted would be like. This was like being stoned on bad, cheap dope. Olin did this. Olin hypnotized you, but you're going to break out of it. You're going to spend the goddamn night in this room, and not just because it's the best location you've ever been in. Leave out Olin, and you've got damn near enough for the ghost story of the decade already. But because Olin doesn't get to win. Him and his bullshit story about how 30 people have died in here, they don't get to win. I'm the one in charge of bullshit around here, so just breathe in and out. Breathe in and out. In and out. He went on like that for nearly 90 seconds, and when he opened his eyes again, he felt normal. The pictures on the wall, still straight. Fruit in the bowl, still yellow-orange and uglier than ever. Desert fruit, for sure. Eat one piece of that and you'd shit until it hurt. He pushed record. The red eye went on. "I had a little vertigo for a minute or two," he said, crossing the room to the writing desk in the window with its protective mesh outside. "It might have been a hangover from Olin's yarning, but I could believe I feel a genuine presence here." He felt no such thing, of course, but once it was on tape, he could write almost anything he pleased. "The air is stale. Not musty or foul-smelling. Olin said the place gets aired every time it gets turned, but the turns are quick and, yeah, it's stale. Hey, look at this!" There was an ashtray on the writing desk, one of those little ones made of thick glass that you used to see in hotels everywhere, and in it was a book of matches. On the front was the Hotel Dolphin. In front of the hotel stood a smiling doorman in a very old-fashioned uniform, the kind with shoulder boards, gold frogging, and a cap that looked as if it belonged in a gay bar, perched on the head of a motorcycle ramrod wearing nothing else but a few silver body rings. Going back and forth on Fifth Avenue in front of the hotel were cars from another era, Packards and Hudsons, Studebakers and Finney Chrysler New Yorkers. "The matchbook in the ashtray looks like it comes from about 1955, Mike said, and slipped it into the pocket of his lucky Hawaiian shirt. "I'm keeping it as a souvenir. Now, it's time for a little fresh air." There is a clunk as he sets the minicorder down, presumably on the writing desk. There is a pause, followed by vague sounds and a couple of effortful grunts. After these comes a second pause and then a squeaking sound. "Success," he says. This is a little off mic, but the follow-up is closer. "Success," Mike repeated, picking the minicorder up off the desk. The bottom half wouldn't budge. It's like it's nailed shut, but the top half came down all right. I can hear the traffic on Fifth Avenue, and all the beeping horns have a comforting quality. Someone is playing a saxophone, perhaps in front of the plaza, which is across the street and two blocks down. It reminds me of my brother. Mike stopped abruptly, looking at the little red eye. It seemed to accuse him. Brother? His brother was dead, another fallen soldier in the tobacco wars. Then he relaxed. What of it? These were the spook wars, where Michael Enslin had always come off the winner. As for Donald Enslin, my brother was actually eaten by wolves one winter on the Connecticut Turnpike, he said, then laughed and pushed stop. There is more on the tape, a little more, but that is the final statement of any coherence, the final statement, that is, to which a clear meaning can be ascribed. Mike turned on his heels and looked at the pictures, still hanging perfectly straight, good little pictures that they were. That still life, though, what an ugly fucking thing that was. He pushed record and spoke two words, "Fuming oranges," into the minicorder. Then he turned it off again and walked across the room to the door leading into the bedroom. He paused by the evening dress lady and reached into the darkness, feeling for the light switch. He had just one moment to register, "It feels like skin, like old dead skin." Something wrong with the wallpaper under his sliding palm, and then his fingers found the switch. The bedroom was flooded with yellow light from another of those ceiling fixtures buried in hanging glass baubles. The bed was a double, hiding under a yellow-orange coverlet. "Why say hiding?" Mike asked the minicorder, then pushed the stop button again. He stepped in, fascinated by the fuming desert of the coverlet, by the tumorous bulges of the pillows beneath it. "Sleep there?" "Not at all, sir. It would be like sleeping inside that goddamn still life, sleeping in that horrible hot Paul Bowles room you couldn't quite see, a room for lunatic expatriate Englishmen who were blind from syphilis caught while fucking their mothers, the film version starring either Lawrence Harvey or Jeremy Irons, one of those actors you just naturally associated with unnatural acts." Mike pushed record. The little red eye came on. He said, "Oedipus on the Orpheum circuit," into the mic, then pushed stop again. He approached the bed. The coverlet gleamed yellow-orange. The wallpaper, perhaps cream-colored by daylight, had picked up the yellow-orange glow of the coverlet. There was a little night table to either side of the bed. On one was a telephone, black and large and equipped with a dial. The finger holes in the dial looked like surprised white eyes. On the other table was a dish with a plum on it. Mike pushed record and said, "That isn't a real plum. That's a plastic plum." He pushed stop again. On the bed itself was a doorknob menu. Mike sidled up one side of the bed, being quite careful to touch neither the bed or the wall, and picked the menu up. He tried not to touch the coverlet either, but the tips of his fingers brushed it, and he moaned. It was soft in some terrible wrong way. Nevertheless, he picked the menu up. It was in French, and although it had been years since he had studied the language, one of the breakfast items appeared to be birds roasted in shit. "That at least sounds like something the French might eat," he thought, and uttered a wild, distracted laugh. He closed his eyes and opened them. The menu was in Russian. He closed his eyes and opened them. The menu was in Italian. Closed his eyes, opened them. There was no menu. There was a picture of a screaming little woodcut boy looking back over his shoulder at the woodcut wolf, which had swallowed his left leg up to the knee. The wolf's ears were laid back, and he looked like a terrier with its favorite toy. "I don't see that," Mike thought, and of course he didn't. Without closing his eyes, he saw neat lines of English, each line listing a different breakfast temptation. Eggs, waffles, fresh berries, no birds roasted in shit. Still, he turned around and very slowly edged himself out of the little space between the wall and the bed, a space that now felt as narrow as a grave. His heart was beating so hard that he could feel it in his neck and wrists as well as in his chest. His eyes were throbbing in their sockets. 1408 was wrong. Yes, indeed. 1408 was very wrong. Olin had said something about poison gas, and that was what Mike felt like, someone who has been gassed or forced to smoke strong hashish laced with insect poison. Olin had done this, of course, probably with the active laughing connivance of the security people, pumped his special poison gas up through the vents. Just because he could see no vents didn't mean the vents weren't there. Mike looked around the bedroom with wide, frightened eyes. There was no plum on the end table to the left of the bed, no plate either. The table was bare. He turned, started for the door leading back to the living room, and stopped. There was a picture on the wall. He couldn't be absolutely sure. In his present state, he couldn't be absolutely sure of his own name. But he was fairly sure that there had been no picture there when he first came in. It was a still life. A single plum sat on a tin plate in the middle of an old plank table. The light falling across the plum and the plate was a feverish yellow-orange. Tango light, he thought. The kind of light that makes the dead get up out of their graves and tango. The kind of light... I have to get out of here, he whispered, and blundered back into the living room. He became aware that his shoes had begun to make odd smooching sounds, as if the floor beneath them were growing soft. The pictures on the living room wall were crooked again, and there were other changes as well. The lady on the stairs had pulled down the top of her gown, baring her breasts. She held one in each hand. A drop of blood hung from each nipple. She was staring directly into Mike's eyes and grinning ferociously. Her teeth were filed to cannibal points. At the rail of the sailing ship, the tars had been replaced by a line of pallid men and women. The man on the far left, nearest the ship's bow, wore a brown wool suit and held a derby hat in one hand. His hair was slicked to his brow and parted in the middle. His face was shocked and vacant. Mike knew his name, Kevin O'Malley, this room's first occupant, a sewing machine salesman who had jumped in October of 1910. To O'Malley's left were the others who had died here, all with that same vacant, shocked expression. It made them look related, all members of the same inbred and cataclysmically retarded family. In the picture where the fruit had been, there was now a severed human head. Yellow-orange light swam off the sunken cheeks, the sagging lips, the upturned glazing eyes. The cigarette parked behind the right ear. Mike blundered toward the door, his feet smooching and now actually seeming to stick a little at each step. The door wouldn't open, of course. The chain hung unengaged. The thumb bolt stood straight up like clock hands pointing to 6 o'clock, but the door wouldn't open. Breathing rapidly, Mike turned from it and waited, that was what it felt like, across the room to the writing desk. He could see the curtains beside the window he had cracked open, waving desultorily, but he could feel no fresh air against his face. It was as though the room were swallowing it. He could still hear horns on Fifth, but they were now very distant. Did he still hear the saxophone? If so, the room had stolen its sweetness and melody and left only an atonal reedy drone like the wind blowing across a hole in a dead man's neck or a pop bottle filled with severed fingers or... Stop it, he tried to say, but he could no longer speak. His heart was hammering at a terrible pace. If it went much faster, it would explode. His minicorder, faithful companion of many case expeditions, was no longer in his hand. He had left it somewhere. In the bedroom? If it was in the bedroom, it was probably gone by now, swallowed by the room. When it was digested, it would be excreted into one of the pictures. Gasping for breath like a runner nearing the end of a long race, Mike put a hand to his chest as if to soothe his heart. What he felt in the left breast pocket of his gaudy shirt was the small square shape of the minicorder. The feel of it, so solid and known, steadied him a little, brought him back a little. He became aware that he was humming, and that the room seemed to be humming back at him, as if myriad mouths were concealed beneath its smoothly nasty wallpaper. He was aware that his stomach was now so nauseated that it seemed to be swinging in its own greasy hammock. He could feel the air crowding against his ears in soft, coagulating clots, and it made him think of how fudge was when it reached the soft ball stage. But he was back a little, enough to be positive of one thing. he had to call for help while there was still time. The thought of Olin smirking in his deferential New York hotel manager way and saying, "I told you so," didn't bother him, and the idea that Olin had somehow induced these strange perceptions and horrible fears by chemical means had entirely left his mind. It was the room. It was the goddamned room. He meant to jab out a hand to the old-fashioned telephone, the twin of the one in the bedroom, and snatch it up. Instead, he watched his arm descend to the table in a kind of delirious slow motion, so like the arm of a diver he almost expected to see bubbles rising from it. He closed his fingers around the handset and picked it up. His other hand dove as deliberately as the first and dialed O. As he put the handset of the phone against his ear, he heard a series of clicks as the dial spun back to its original position. It sounded like the wheel on Wheel of Fortune. Do you want to spin or do you want to solve the puzzle? Remember that if you try to solve the puzzle and fail, you will be put out into the snow beside the Connecticut Turnpike and the wolves will eat you. There was no ring in his ear. Instead, a harsh voice simply began speaking. This is 9. 9. This is 9. 9. This is 10. 10. We have killed your friends. Every friend is now dead. This is 6. 6. Mike listened with growing horror, not at what the voice was saying, but at its rasping emptiness. It was not a machine-generated voice, but it wasn't a human voice either. It was the voice of the room. The presence pouring out of the walls and the floor, the presence speaking to him from the telephone, had nothing in common with any haunting or paranormal event he had ever read about. There was something alien here. No, not here yet, but coming. It's hungry, and your dinner. The phone fell from his relaxing fingers, and he turned around. It swung at the end of its cord the way his stomach was swinging back and forth inside him, and he could still hear that voice rasping out of the black. 18! This is now 18! Take cover when the siren sounds! This is 4! 4! He was not aware of taking the cigarette from behind his ear and putting it in his mouth, or of fumbling the book of matches with the old-fashioned gold frog dormant on it out of his bright shirt's right breast pocket, not aware that, after 9 years, he had finally decided to have a smoke. Before him, the room had begun to melt. It was sagging out of its right angles and straight lines, not into curves, but into strange Moorish arcs that hurt his eyes. The glass chandelier in the center of the ceiling began to sag like a thick glob of spit. The pictures began to bend, turning into shapes like the windshields of old cars. From behind the glass of the picture by the door leading into the bedroom, the 20s woman with the bleeding nipples and grinning cannibal teeth whirled around and ran back up the stairs, going with the jerky, delirious, high knee-pistoning of a vamp in a silent movie. The telephone continued to grind and spit, the voice coming from it now the voice of an electric hair clipper that has learned how to talk. 5! This is 5! Ignore the siren! Even if you leave this room, you can never leave this room! 8! This is 8! The door to the bedroom and the door to the hall had begun to collapse downward, widening in the middle and becoming doorways for beings possessed of unspeakable shapes. The light began to grow bright and hot, filling the room with that yellow-orange glow. Now he could see rips in the wallpaper, black pores that quickly grew to become mouths. The floor sank into a concave arc, and now he could hear it coming, the dweller in the room behind the room, the thing in the walls, the owner of the buzzing voice. 6! The phone screamed. 6! This is 6! This is goddamn fucking 6! He looked down at the matchbook in his hand, the one he had plucked out of the bedroom ashtray. Funny old doorman, funny old cars with their big chrome grills, and words running across the bottom that he hadn't seen in a long time, because now the strip of abrasive stuff was always on the back. close cover before striking. Without thinking about it, he no longer could think. Mike Enslin tore out a single match, allowing the cigarette to drop out of his mouth at the same time. He struck the match and immediately touched it to the others in the book. There was a pfft sound, a strong whiff of burning sulfur that went into his head like a whiff of smelling salts, and a bright flare of match heads. And again, without so much as a single thought, Mike held the flaring bouquet of fire against the front of his shirt. It was a cheap thing made in Korea or Cambodia or Borneo, old now. It caught fire at once. Before the flames could blaze up in front of his eyes, rendering the room once more unstable, Mike saw it clearly, like a man who is awakened from a nightmare, only to find the nightmare all around him. His head was clear. The strong whiff of sulfur and the sudden rising heat from his shirt had done that much, but the room maintained its insanely Moorish aspect. Moorish was wrong, not even very close, but it was the only word that seemed even to reach toward what had happened here, what was still happening. He was in a melting, rotting cave full of swoops and mad tilts. The door to the bedroom had become the door to some sarcophagal inner chamber. And to his left, where the picture of the fruit had been, the wall was bulging outward toward him, splitting open in those long cracks that gaped like mouths, opening on a world from which something was now approaching. Mike Enslin could hear its slobbering, avid breath, and smell something alive and dangerous. It smelled a little like the lion house in the... Then flame scorched the undershelf of his chin, banishing thought. The heat rising from his blazing shirt put that waver back into the world, and as he began to smell the crispy aroma of his chest hair starting to fry, Mike again bolted across the sagging rug to the hall door. An insectal buzzing sound had begun to sweat out of the walls. The yellow-orange light was steadily brightening, as if a hand were turning up an invisible rheostat. But this time, when he reached the door and turned the knob, the door opened. It was as if the thing behind the bulging wall had no use for a burning man, did not, perhaps, relish cooked meat. 3. A popular song from the 50s suggests that love makes the world go round, but coincidence would probably be a better bet. Rufus Dearborn, who was staying that night in room 1414, up near the elevators, was a salesman for the Singer Sewing Machine Company, in town from Texas to talk about moving up to an executive position. And so it happened that 90 or so years after room 1408's first occupant jumped to his death, another sewing machine salesman saved the life of the man who had come to write about the purportedly haunted room. Or perhaps that is an exaggeration. Mike Enslin might have lived even if no one, especially a fellow on his way back from a visit to the ice machine, had been in the hallway at that moment. Having your shirt catch fire is no joke, though, and he certainly would have been burned much more severely and extensively if not for Dearborn, who thought fast and moved even faster. Not that Dearborn ever remembered exactly what happened. He constructed a coherent enough story for the newspapers and TV cameras. He liked the idea of being a hero very much, and it certainly did no harm to his executive aspirations. And he clearly remembered seeing the man on fire lunge out into the hall, but after that, everything was a blur. Thinking about it was like trying to reconstruct the things you had done during the vilest, deepest drunk of your life. One thing he was sure of, but didn't tell any of the reporters because it made no sense. The burning man's scream seemed to grow in volume, as if he were a stereo that was being turned up. He was right there in front of Dearborn, and the pitch of the scream never changed, but the volume most certainly did. It was as if the man were some incredibly loud object that was just arriving here. Dearborn ran down the hall with the full ice bucket in his hand. The burning man... It was just his shirt on fire, I saw that right away, he told the reporters. Struck the door opposite the room he had come out of, rebounded, staggered, and fell to his knees. That was when Dearborn reached him. He He put his foot on the burning shoulder of the screaming man's shirt and pushed him over onto the hall carpet. Then he dumped the contents of the ice bucket onto him. These things were blurred in his memory, but accessible. He was aware that the burning shirt seemed to be casting far too much light, a sweltering yellow-orange light that made him think of a trip he and his brother had made to Australia 2 years before. They had rented an all-wheel drive and had taken off across the Great Australian Desert. The few natives called it the Great Australian Bugger-All, the Dearborn brothers discovered. A hell of a trip. Great, but spooky. Especially the big rock in the middle, Ayers Rock. They had reached it right around sunset, and the light on its many faces was like this, hot and strange. Not really what you thought of as earth light at all. He dropped beside the burning man, who was now only the smoldering man, the covered with ice cubes man, and rolled him over to stifle the flames reaching around to the back of the shirt. When he did, he saw the skin on the left side of the man's neck had gone a smoky, bubbly red, and the lobe of his ear on that side had melted a little. But otherwise... otherwise... Dearborn looked up, and it seemed... this was crazy, but it seemed the door to the room the man had come out of was filled with the burning light of an Australian sundown, the hot light of an empty place where things no man has ever seen might live. It was terrible, that light, and the low buzzing, like an electric clipper that was trying desperately to speak. But it was fascinating, too. He wanted to go into it. He wanted to see what was behind it. Perhaps Mike saved Dearborn's life as well. He was certainly aware that Dearborn was getting up, as if Mike no longer held any interest for him, and that his face was filled with the blazing, pulsing light coming out of 1408. He remembered this better than Dearborn later did himself, but of course, Rufe Dearborn had not been reduced to setting himself on fire in order to survive. Mike grabbed the cuff of Dearborn's slacks.
"Don't go in there," he said in a cracked, smoky voice. "You'll never come out."
Dearborn stopped, looking down at the reddening, blistering face of the man on the carpet.
"It's haunted," Mike said.
And as if the words had been a talisman, the door of room 1408 slammed furiously shut, cutting off the light, cutting off the terrible buzz that was almost words. Rufus Dearborn, one of Singer Sewing Machine's finest, ran down to the elevators and pulled the fire alarm. 4. There's an interesting picture of Mike Enslin in Treating the Burn Victim, a Diagnostic Approach, the 16th edition of which appeared about 16 months after Mike's short stay in room 1408 of the Hotel Dolphin. The photo shows just his torso, but it's Mike all right. One can tell by the white square on the left side of his chest. The flesh all around it is an angry red, actually blistered into second-degree burns in some places. The white square marks the left breast pocket of the shirt he was wearing that night, the lucky shirt, with his mini-quarter in the pocket. The mini-quarter itself melted around the corners, but it still works, and the tape inside it was fine. It's the things on it which are not fine. After listening to it 3 or 4 times, Mike's agent, Sam Farrell, tossed it into his wall safe, refusing to acknowledge the goose flesh all over his tanned, scrawny arms. In that wall safe, the tape has stayed ever since. Farrell has no urge to take it out and play it again, not for himself, not for his curious friends, some of whom would cheerfully kill to hear it. New York publishing is a small community, and word gets around. He doesn't like Mike's voice on the tape. He doesn't like the stuff that voice is saying. My brother was actually eaten by wolves one winter on the Connecticut Turnpike. What in God's name is that supposed to mean? And most of all, he doesn't like the background sounds on the tape, a kind of liquid smooshing that sometimes sounds like clothes churning around in an oversudsed washer, sometimes like one of those old electric hair clippers, and sometimes, weirdly, like a voice. While Mike was still in the hospital, a man named Olin, the manager of the goddamned hotel, if you please, came and asked Sam Farrell if he could listen to that tape. Farrell said no, he couldn't. What Olin could do was take himself on out of the agent's office at a rapid hike and thank God all the way back to the flea bag where he worked that Mike Enslin had decided not to sue either the hotel or Olin for negligence. I tried to persuade him not to go in, Olin said quietly. A man who spent most of his working days listening to tired travelers and petulant guests bitch about everything from their rooms to the magazine selection in the newsstand, he wasn't much perturbed by Farrell's rancor. I tried everything in my power. If anyone was negligent that night, Mr. Farrell, it was your client. He believed too much in nothing. Very unwise behavior. Very unsafe behavior. I would guess he has changed somewhat in that regard. In spite of Farrell's distaste for the tape, he would like Mike to listen to it, acknowledge it, perhaps use it as a pad from which to launch a new book. There is a book in What Happened to Mike. Farrell knows it. Not just a chapter, a 40-page case history, but an entire book, one that might outsell all three of the 10 Nights books combined. And of course he doesn't believe Mike's assertion that he has finished not only with ghost tales, but with all writing. Writers say that from time to time, that's all. The occasional prima donna outburst is part of what makes writers in the first place. As for Mike Enslin himself, he got off lucky, all things considered, and he knows it. He could have been burned much more badly than he actually was. If not for Mr. Dearborn and his bucket of ice, he might have had 20 or even 30 different skin graft procedures to suffer through instead of only 4. His neck is scarred on the left side in spite of the grafts, but the doctors at the Boston Burn Institute tell him the scars will fade on their own. He also knows that the burns, painful as they were in the weeks and months after that night, were necessary. If not for the matches with "close cover before striking" written on the front, he would have died in 1408, and his end would have been unspeakable. To a coroner, it might have looked like a stroke or a heart attack, but the actual cause of death would have been much nastier. Much nastier. He was also lucky in having produced 3 popular books on ghosts and hauntings before actually running afoul of a place that is haunted. This he also knows. Sam Farrell may not believe Mike's life as a writer is over, but Sam doesn't need to. Mike knows it for both of them. He cannot so much as write a postcard without feeling cold all over his skin and being nauseated deep in the pit of his belly. Sometimes just looking at a pen or a tape recorder will make him think, "The pictures were crooked. I tried to straighten the pictures." He doesn't know what this means. He can't remember the pictures or anything else from room 1408, and he is glad. That is a mercy. His blood pressure isn't so good these days. His doctor told him that burn victims often develop problems with their blood pressure and put him on medication. His eyes trouble him. His optometrist told him to start taking Ocuvites. He has consistent back problems. His prostate has gotten too large. But he can deal with these things. He knows he isn't the first person to escape 1408 without really escaping. Olin tried to tell him. But it isn't all bad. At least he doesn't remember. Sometimes he has nightmares, quite often, in fact. Almost every goddamn night, in fact. But he rarely remembers them when he wakes up. A sense that things are rounding off at the corners, mostly, melting the way the corners of his mini-quarter melted. He lives on Long Island these days, and when the weather is good, he takes long walks on the beach. The closest he has ever come to articulating what he does remember about his 70-odd, very odd, minutes in 1408 was on one of those walks. "It was never human," he said to the incoming waves in a choked, halting voice. "Ghosts, at least ghosts, were once human. The thing in the wall, though, that thing." Time may improve it. He can and does hope for that. Time may fade it, as it will fade the scars on his neck. In the meantime, though, He sleeps with the lights on in his bedroom, so he will know at once where he is when he wakes up from the bad dreams. He has had all the phones taken out of the house. At some point, just below the place where his conscious mind seems able to go, he is afraid of picking the phone up and hearing a buzzing, inhuman voice spit,
"This is 9. 9. We have killed your friends. Every friend is now dead."
And when the sun goes down on clear evening, he pulls every shade and blind and drape in the house. He sits like a man in a dark room until his watch tells him the light, even the last fading glow along the horizon, must be gone. He can't stand the light that comes at sunset, that yellow deepening to orange, like light in the desert. In the Death Room. It was a death room. Fletcher knew it for what it was as soon as the door opened. The floor was gray industrial tile. The walls were discolored white stone, marked here and there with darker patches that might have been blood. Certainly blood had been spilled in this room. The overhead lights were cupped in wire cages. Halfway across the room stood a long wooden table with three people seated behind it. Before the table was an empty chair, waiting for Fletcher. Beside the chair stood a small wheeled trolley. The object on it had been draped with a piece of cloth, as a sculptor might cover his work in progress between sessions. Fletcher was half led, half dragged toward the chair which had been placed for him. He reeled in the guard's grip and let himself reel. If he looked more dazed than he really was, more shocked and unthinking, that was fine. He thought his chances of ever leaving this basement room in the Ministry of Information were perhaps 1 or 2 in 30, and perhaps that was optimistic. Whatever they were, he had no intention of thinning them further by looking even halfway alert. His swelled eyes, puffy nose, and broken lower lip might help in this regard. So might the crust of blood, like a dark red goatee, around his mouth. One thing Fletcher knew for sure. If he did leave, the others, the guard and the three sitting in tribunal behind the table, would be dead. He was a newspaper reporter and had never killed anything much larger than a hornet, but if he had to kill to escape this room, he would. He thought of his sister on her retreat. He thought of his sister swimming in a river with a Spanish name. He thought of the light on the water at noon, moving river light too bright to look at. They reached the chair in front of the table. The guard pushed him into it so hard that Fletcher almost tipped himself over.
"Careful now. That's not the way. No accidents," said one of the men behind the table.
It was Escobar. He spoke to the guard in Spanish. To Escobar's left sat another man. To Escobar's right sat a woman of about 60. The woman and the other man were thin. Escobar was fat and as greasy as a cheap candle. He looked like a movie Mexican. You expected him to say, "Batches? Batches? We don't need no stinking Batches." Yet this was the chief minister of information. Sometimes he gave the English language portion of the weather on the city television station. When he did this, he invariably got fan mail. In a suit, he didn't look greasy, just roly-poly. Fletcher knew all this. He had done 3 or 4 stories on Escobar. He was colorful. He was also, according to rumor, an enthusiastic torturer. A Central American Himmler, Fletcher thought, and was amazed to discover that one sense of humor, rudimentary, granted, could function this far into a state of terror. "Handcuffs?" the guard asked, also in Spanish, and held up a pair of the plastic kind. Fletcher tried to keep his look of dazed incomprehension. If they cuffed him, it was over. He could forget about one chance in 30, or one in 300. Escobar turned briefly to the woman on his right. Her face was very dark, her hair black with startling white streaks. It flowed back and up from her forehead as if blown by a gale-force wind. The look of her hair reminded Fletcher of Elsa Lanchester in The Bride of Frankenstein. He gripped this similarity with a fierceness that was close to panic, the way he gripped the thought of bright light on the river, or his sister laughing with her friends as they walked to the water. He wanted images, not ideas. Images were luxury items now, and ideas were no good in a place like this. In a place like this, all you got were the wrong ideas. The woman gave Escobar a small nod. Fletcher had seen her around the building, always garbed in shapeless dresses like the one she wore now. She had been with Escobar often enough for Fletcher to assume she was his secretary, personal assistant, perhaps even his biographer. Christ knew that men like Escobar had egos large enough to warrant such accessories. Now Fletcher wondered if he'd had it backwards all along. If she was his boss. In any case, the nod seemed to satisfy Escobar. When he turned back to Fletcher, Escobar was smiling, and when he spoke, it was in English. "Don't be silly. Put them away. Mr. Fletcher is only here to help us in a few matters. He will soon be returning to his own country." Escobar sighed deeply to show how deeply he regretted this. "But in the meantime, he is an honored guest."
"We don't need no stinking handcuffs," Fletcher thought.
The woman who looked like the Bride of Frankenstein with a very deep tan leaned toward Escobar and whispered briefly behind her hand. Escobar nodded, smiling.
"Of course, Ramon. If our guest should try anything foolish or make any aggressive moves, you would have to shoot him a little."
He roared in laughter, roly-poly TV laughter, and then repeated what he had said in Spanish, so that Ramon would understand as well as Fletcher. Ramon nodded seriously, replaced his handcuffs on his belt, and stepped back to the periphery of Fletcher's vision. Escobar returned his attention to Fletcher. From one pocket of his parrot and foliage-studded guayabara, he removed a red and white package, Marlboro's, the preferred cigarette of third-world peoples everywhere. "Smoke, Mr. Fletcher?" Fletcher reached toward the pack, which Escobar had placed on the edge of the table, then withdrew his hand. He had quit smoking 3 years ago and supposed he might take up the habit again if he actually did get out of this, drinking high-tension liquor as well, quite likely. But at this moment, he had no craving or need for a cigarette. He had wanted them to see his fingers shaking, that was all. Perhaps later. Right now a cigarette might